Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I am Ryan Van Winkle, your host. It's such a pleasure to be in your ears today and to talk about books with three fantastic authors. Today on the podcast, we've got the author Ken MacLeod. He's a legendary sci-fi writer, and we're going to talk a little bit about science fiction in his latest novel, as well as a little bit about stem cell research and this really interesting comic book that he helped put together. We've also got Tim Sinclair. He's an Australian novelist who has written a book about parkour and about this really, really interesting subculture that's taking place throughout the world, and you're going to hear a little bit from him about that novel. But first, Kirsty Logan. She was the recipient of a New Writers Award from the Scottish Book Trust, and her debut collection of short stories is called The Rental Heart and Other Fairy Tales. It comes out this month, and we're going to start off with Kirsty just reading one of her stories.
This is a story that I wrote a few years ago for the Scottish Book Trust, and it was broadcast on Woman's Hour, so The Light Eater. It began with the Christmas tree lights. They were candy bright, mouth size. She wanted to feel the lightness of them on her tongue, the spark on her taste buds. Without him, life was so dark, and all the holiday debris only made it worse. She promised herself she wouldn't bite down. The bulb was sweet and sharp, and it slid down her throat with a feeling of relief, an itch finally scratched. She came to with a shock. At the realization of what she'd done, she tangled the lights back into their box and pushed them onto the highest shelf. The next day, she pulled down the box and ate the rest. The power cable was slippery as licorice. She got hungrier as the days passed. A light bulb blew. She went to change it, but ended up sucking it like a lollipop. She enjoyed its gobstoppery taste and had soon eaten the rest of the bulbs in the house. Lamps mushroomed up from every flat surface, and there's no good in a darkened light. Each day she visited the hardware shop and walked home with bags full to clinking. Her eyes were always full of light. With each blink, she caught gold on her eyelashes. One night, she opened her mouth to yawn and saw that her path was lit. Up she jumped, pajamaed and barefoot, and followed the light across streets and playgrounds, fields and forests, all the way to the edge of the land. She paused on the rocks, between the trees at her back and the black of the sea. This is where he left, and this is where she could find him again. She stretched her body to the sky in readiness, then opened her mouth to outshine the stars. She spat out the bulbs, 1, 2, 19, 20, in a runway from trees to shore. She spread herself out on the sand. A perfect starfish, a fallen body, an X, so he could find his way back.
He's not coming back, is he?
No. I wrote that actually quite soon. My dad died very suddenly when I was 27. We still don't really know what happened. It was all quite mysterious. But it was a difficult time. It was a complicated time. And I think I'd never really experienced quite such a huge emotion before. And I think writing these little kind of surreal stories can really help with these big emotions. It's really difficult to process big emotions sometimes, and for me anyway, thinking of it in a more of a metaphorical sense, it did help me to go through that.
Was it afterwards that you realized that this was coming from a place of grief, or were you aware that when you sat down, this character is partly me?
Well, I think every character you write both is and is not you. I don't think that any writer writes anything that's completely autobiographical, but then everything is a little bit autobiographical. So the character in the story is not me. The person that they've lost is not my father, but it is. Any story about loss can be about your loss or my loss, everybody's loss. And perhaps that's why I'm so into this fairy tale, mythical type feel to stories, because I feel that connects with this archetype that when you have a fairy tale or a myth, any father is your father, my father, everyone's father. And I think that's why they're so timeless.
Because it does very specifically say, and other fairy tales. So were you writing fairy tales kind of as you were putting this collection together? Are there stories that weren't in there that you were like, that's not fairy tale enough? that it couldn't make it into the collection? Or were you consciously creating like fairy tales for your first book?
Well, I actually didn't write the stories with a collection in mind. I wrote them over the course of about 5 years, and it was only later that I put them together in a collection. And there were stories that I'm really fond of that I didn't put in because they just didn't fit in with the rest of the stories. So there wasn't any point where I sat down and thought, must write fairy tale now. It's just how it came out. It's just what I do. It's what I'm interested in. It's what I like to read. And I'm using fairy tale in the loosest possible sense. Very few of the stories are actual retellings of classic fairy tales. I think only one or two, really. And even then, it's a loose retelling. It's more taking the ideas of fairy tales, the language and the tropes and the settings. I always like to write about these big settings, which could be anywhere, like the sea, the forest, the town, the city, could be anywhere, but it's wherever the reader wants it to be.
And they've got that weird kind of dreamy quality to them where kind of anything can happen and it's all okay, because you can kind of very quickly settle into the idea that, yeah, somebody's going to eat Christmas lights. Sure. Yeah, sure. And then, of course, why wouldn't you progress to eating light bulbs? And you go to some strange places. You've got Baba Yaga in the book. You go to the circus. Where else do you take us in this collection?
We go to some Scottish islands. We go to New Orleans in 1920s. Go to the Australian outback. We go kind of all over the world.
Yeah, you're hanging out in Paris.
Yeah, coin-operated boys.
Yeah, right. Like, so that's like not a fairy tale, the idea of a kind of a Pinocchio-ish boy is very fairy tale.
Yeah, maybe it's just the way my mind works. It all makes sense to me that if you are sad and the world looks dark, that you would eat light. I should clarify, I have not actually literally eaten Christmas tree lights. Just to me, it makes sense that you would do that. And it would make sense with the coin-operated boys that if you are finding it difficult to connect with a human, you would want a clockwork boy, a clockwork partner. So I suppose it's just maybe my mind works in metaphor in that way.
But you have presumably put your tongue in between a 9-volt battery, right?
No, I would be too scared that maybe I watched too many cartoons when I was a kid. I would be scared I would get that electric vertical hair thing going on, you know.
You said that you've been writing this book over the course of like about 5 years. I know that you were a recipient of the Scottish Book Trust New Writers Award. Can you tell us a little bit about how that program helped?
It was brilliant. I loved it. Every single year when it comes time for people to apply, I go on and on and on at all the new writers that I know, like, you must apply. It's amazing. It's a great program. There's a really nice book ending actually with mine, because I received the award for a short story called The Rental Heart. And then here we are, you know, 4 or 5 years later, the book is The Rental Heart. So that's quite nice. And it really was massively helpful. The thing about the Scottish Book Trust is they don't just help you once. I go back to them all the time. I'm still speaking to them about like how to promote my book, how to approach various editors and things, which I was completely clueless about. But they've been great with helping me with that. There are so few times in your life that you'll get such intense attention on your work, you'll get such intense editing that someone will perhaps even go line by line with you. And that just these days doesn't tend to happen unless you're extremely lucky with your agent or your editor.
Is this one of those collections where you feel like you have to read it from cover to cover, or are you happy with people as a short story writer picking a place, finding a title that they think is interesting and just going with it?
Yeah, read them in absolutely any order you want. There is a kind of narrative if you read it from beginning to end, but you will not miss anything if you just pick the ones that look interesting. If you only have a couple of minutes, read one of the really short ones. If you've got a bit more time, read one of the longer ones.
Kirsty Logan, everybody. The book is called The Rental Heart and Other Fairy Tales. The book comes out this month, and you can go along to the launch. It happens in Glasgow at the Waterstones there on Argyle Street. It's on the 23rd of March at 6 p.m. Go out, get a copy of the book, and you'll enjoy some really fantastic short stories. So up next, I was recently in Australia, and one of the joys of being able to travel a little bit and go to book festivals and things is, of course, I get a chance to meet super interesting people who are involved in trying out new things and exploring different things that I don't know anything about. And one of those people was Tim Sinclair, the novelist and poet. Now, Tim's written a book called Run, and Run is a young adult novel, which is kind of genre fiction, but it's also literary fiction, and it's written in verse. It's poetry on the page. It's got concrete poetry on the page. And so it was a real pleasure to sit down with him and talk to him about this fascinating novel, Run.
Basically, it's about a young guy who lives in Sydney. He's into parkour. He has a very active fantasy life because he has a boring life like a lot of teenagers do. And he gets himself into a little more trouble than he anticipated when he starts breaking into military bases and so on. This is from the beginning. 9:15, Wednesday night. I walk. One foot and then the next, just like everyday people. Feet on the ground, just like everyday people. My folks think I'm going to Jesse's house. The people around me probably don't care. Everyday people. Everyday lives. It's the thing I rely on. The perfect disguise. Through the quaint of Glebe to the modern of Ultimo, then down along the overpass to Chinatown. This is where it starts to get interesting. I stand on the overpass, heart pounding, force myself to breathe, force the world to slow down around me. Breathe in to the here, breathe out to the now. Breathe in right here, breathe out right now. This is happening. I'm aware of everything that's going on around me, almost like I can see 360. The cars crisscrossing on the road behind me, the flashing LEDs of a cyclist on the ramp, the straggling family hauling their shopping bags, slowly coming up to my right. And the train. The monorail stopped at the station in front of me, headlights shining down its single track, ready to glide on its 80s way forward, directly underneath me. It's like clockwork choreography, and it's the bit I love the best. None of these people know their parts, but I'm bringing them together in a film they'll never see. The train starts to move as the bike rolls past me, accelerates smoothly as the family troops past. The mother grips tiny hands. The father eyes me off for threat, dismisses me with a glance. Just some kid watching the trains. Perfect. Underneath us all, an electric whine as the carriages shunt past. I look again at my destination, Convention Center Station. 400 meters between here and there, a stretching line of suspended steel poised above the streets. There's a turnstile at the station I'm looking forward to jumping, an attendant to scare the living crap from. But now, it's time. I flip my hood, one last breath. I vault the rail, heels steady on the ledge, then drop.
For people who don't know, would you mind explaining what parkour is, or maybe what even parkour is to you, and have you done it?
Yeah, absolutely. So parkour is a word that's often used as a replacement word is free running. They're not exactly the same thing, but it helps to give you an idea. So basically, it's just about moving through the environment, mostly the urban environment, in a way that doesn't really allow for boundaries. You're jumping over things, you're climbing up things. Everybody's seen the James Bond version where you're jumping around amongst cranes and very tall buildings, but it's not all like that. You know, the more I started to learn about parkour, the more I realized it's very detailed philosophy about it. It's a very thoughtful kind of discipline. It's more like a martial art, really.
Do you mean like there's a political or cultural significance to it? Is there a manifesto? Is there a parkour ideology?
There's all of those things. Apart from the manifesto, it's not quite that formalized. No, I mean, it developed, you know, it was a bunch of guys in France growing up in the ugly outer suburbs of Paris, basically relegated to the edge of this beautiful city by society, being told they didn't have much opportunities in their lives. And instead of going, all right, we live in these horrible apartment blocks, we have nothing much going on, they decided to transcend those limitations. So they're instead of seeing a big apartment block, they're seeing a way to scale up the wall and a way to jump over and a way to move through that. And I think that philosophy really has come through. I actually went and trained for a little bit myself. I have to say I'm in my 40s now and most of the kids were kids, literally. And, you know, I saw a hell of a lot of my physio during that time. But, man, I loved it. I mean, it's just such a freeing way to move through the city. And I did it just for a couple of months, but that was enough time to start to look at the world differently. And, you know, you're looking at stairs and you're looking at walls and you're looking at spaces and going, yeah, I could actually do that. I could move through. I'm seeing all these people walking in the way that the path is telling them to walk, but actually I could be jumping that and climbing that and scaling that. It's amazing.
I mean, I guess for the novel, is this idea that the character gets in trouble and falls into trouble, because parkour is not seen as something, or free running is seen as something that you can get arrested for, it, right? And right. And much like something like graffiti or something, which maybe is a bit more of a vandalism thing, parkour doesn't seem like it's causing any trouble, and it seems like you've found a way to use the narrative to highlight this kind of fact that, like, actually these kids who are just trying to be free are being kind of clamped down upon.
Yeah, I mean, it can be completely legal. There's a lot of places to do it. It leaves no marks. I mean, it's not even like skateboarding where, you know, you're damaging things, you're just running across it. He gets into trouble because he's, really, it starts with his ego. I mean, he's approached by some guy who tells him he's trying to make some underground movie for Hollywood and it's going to be this super cool documentary, but he just needs him to break into this military installation. And yeah, that's very unparkour-like of him to respond in that kind of ego way, and that comes back to bite him in the bum, and he realizes that later on in the book, and then he has to get out of the situation.
It's like having a superpower once you start doing it, I imagine, because you could just climb over it, you can go over anything.
Yeah, I mean, when you see the guys who've been doing it for 30 years, it is incredible. It's superhuman. It's beautiful.
Tim Sinclair, everybody. The novel is called Run. Unfortunately, it's not really available here in the UK, so if you get a chance and you want to hear more about the novel, you want to see it physically, you want to own a copy, you can contact Tim Sinclair directly via his website, timsinclair.org. He's also on Twitter, so you can send him a tweet. Or maybe just go straight to the heart of it and contact Penguin Australia on Twitter. Let him know you're really keen to see this book over here in the UK. And also, while we're talking about Twitter, don't forget you can tweet us at the Scottish Book Trust. We're Scottish BK Trust. Or, of course, you can like us on Facebook. Please do. Or just check out our website. There's always new material going up there online. You can find us at scottishbooktrust.com. And lastly on the podcast, we've got Ken MacLeod. He's got a brand new novel out called Descent. He's a really, really well-respected and acclaimed science fiction writer. It was a total pleasure to sit down with him and talk about the new novel, amongst a range of other topics. Here he is, Ken MacLeod.
Ken MacLeod talking about Descent. The book itself, it came out of my previous novel, Intrusion, was a near-future science fiction novel with a strong focus on ordinary people, everyday life, and how they were affected by much larger forces of one kind or another. Descent is kind of in the same vein. My mental marching orders when I was writing Intrusion were that I was going to write the Genomics Aga Saga. The narrator is actually a not terribly admirable character. It starts with him in his early teens and it continues into his late 20s, I guess. And as the narrator of a bloke-lit novel usually does, he learns better but does quite a bit of damage to himself and those closest to him along the way. His excuse, if you like, for being such an odd character is that when he was young and growing up in Greenock, a small town on the west coast of Scotland, he and one of his pals were walking in the hills and got knocked down by a strange light from the sky. The night after that, he has a very strange experience, which he interprets as a dream or a hallucination, but it's in large part quite like the traditional alien abduction scenario. Except that even though he gets taken into the spaceship by a little grey alien, your average working alien, as he puts it, what he meets in the ship is quite different from what he expects. That affects a lot of what happens in the rest of his life. The other thing that's going on in the background of the story is it's set in a near-future Scotland. I'm very careful in the story to kind of elide which way the referendum in September will go. So I haven't been explicit about that. But it's a Scotland that's still, in one way or another, mired in the ongoing economic crisis. The most unlikely thing in the book, which is a worldwide global economic reform gets passed overnight.
That does seem rather unlikely. When is this set? When is the book set?
The book is set, I think it starts probably about 10 years from now. To sum up what the book's about, it's about flying saucers, hidden races, and Antonio Gramsci's theory of passive revolution.
The character in the novel suspects the revolution has already taken place, right?
Exactly, yes. He starts to think that the revolution happened while he wasn't looking, and he also starts to think that his girlfriend, indeed his fiancée, is of a different human species. We've all been there. The idea of a passive revolution was, I think, developed by the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci in the 1930s when he was in prison. And basically it's the idea that at a certain point in long-standing, intractable crises, if there isn't some assembly of popular forces from below to solve it, the existing elites and ruling classes and so on will solve it in their own way, and they carry it through as a radical reform from above. And that essentially is what happens in the book. The parts of the speculative parts of capitalism, the finance and so on, get severely put in their place, and the tax havens get shut down. I greatly enjoyed writing a brief scene where, you know, every tax haven except Switzerland gets invaded simultaneously.
By whom?
By, you know, the US, the UK, even Russia does its bit. You know, they all chip in, invade the tax havens and shut them down. I agree that this probably sounds a little implausible, so I'll probably talk more about the flying saucers.
Because there's this other thing you talk about in the book, which is the idea that there's no evidence of him, the character, being abducted. And they're living in a society that is hyper-watched, I guess. You know, everything's on the internet or CCTV. And I was wondering if you were thinking about things like Snowden and WikiLeaks and all of these things as you were writing the novel, or if that's just not, that didn't come up as a political issue or a topical issue, because it seems very current.
Yeah, I think the Snowden's revelations happened after I'd finished writing the novel, but I've very much taken for granted something rather like what he describes, in that by the time this story comes about, as the character himself says, he takes for granted that every phone call, every email, every text message, every interaction is somehow recorded and could be monitored, that all of this information is available to state agencies. And in fact, later on, he comes to have to react to that. I'm imagining a generation that would be perhaps primary school children now, what it's going to be like when they grow up. They're going to grow up in a world where there are always on gadgets. And in fact, part of the setup of the story is that there's a specific reason why the hero and his pal leave their phones behind. You have to come up with some excuse for doing that, and I think it's a reasonable move. Right at the start, they leave their phones behind, they leave their phones with their friends, and they go out into the hills. And that might be, in a sense, what their downfall is, because they have no evidence of the downfall of a certain aspect of their lives, because they have no evidence of what actually happened to them at that point. That doesn't mean that nobody else has, of course. To get back to the question of surveillance, I do think that it is going to affect people and the texture of everyday life in ways that we can't predict, and quite subtle ways. Like if you assume, for example, that nobody can ever get lost. Everybody assumes that you can't really get lost anymore, because you have your tracking device with you all the time.
Even the idea of, like, just as somebody who likes to wander around, the idea that you can't be lost, you lose that kind of fear as well, you know.
Yeah.
It is harder to get lost. I'm going to miss that at some point in my life.
I think the word is flaneuring. My wife and I have an amazing talent for flaneuring through the dullest back streets of cities. We always find ourselves getting lost in foreign capitals, and usually walking through the streets at precisely the wrong time to be walking through them in terms of finding anything that's actually going on or interesting. I think we've seen half the central business districts of Europe.
It'd be a great postcard series, Ken.
Yes, it would. We once walked through a very dynamic and lively Jewish quarter in Paris, the Marais, but we walked through it on a Saturday afternoon when there was nobody about.
Hey, can you tell me a little bit before we go about this comic book project that you did, which was around the idea of stem cell research?
It's called Hope Beyond Hype. And if you just Google Hope Beyond Hype, you'll find an electronic version of the comic. That came out of a meeting Kathy Southworth, who is one of the public outreach people at the Stem Cell Center, I think it's officially called the Center for Regenerative Medicine. And she approached me about the idea of writing a script for a comic. And neither of us had any idea how to write a comic. So We went and spoke to David Bishop at Napier University, where he's on the MA Creative Writing course. And David Bishop has a long experience with comics. In fact, he was an editor of 2000 AD. And Kathy had come across the work of a young Edinburgh-based and very talented non-fiction comics artist and writer, Edward Ross. Edward has a wonderfully warm, human style of cartooning. He creates characters and images that you can really sympathize with. And we spent quite a bit of time reading up about stem cells, talking to one of the pioneers of stem cell therapy, Professor Michaela De Luca, who had himself been involved in one of the very first therapeutic applications of stem cells way back in the early 70s in Boston. And that story from Boston of two little boys who got very severely burned and whose lives were saved by using skin stem cells to literally grow new skin for them. Edward said that's like the origin story, and it was. And we told that story, and we went through explaining what stem cells are, how they can be applied, and the ethical and political issues that are raised, and so on, and how important it is not to get carried away by the hype, which is a kind of necessary consequence of the way that scientists, researchers, companies, etc., have to, you know, arouse interest in what they're doing in order to get funding, but at the same time they can raise unrealistic expectations. Our script and even our drawings, as the technical parts of his drawings, went through quite a few critical readings from scientists at the center until we got it right. I'm really happy about that. In terms of readers per word, as it were, that must have been the most read piece of writing I've ever done. Within a few days of it being online, over 100,000 people had read it. Beat that. And Barbara Melville, a former student on the MA Creative Writing course at Napier, is now writer in residence at the centre and works with Kathy. And she has worked with Edward Ross in producing a sequel to the Hope Beyond Hype comic. It's called, I think, Stem Cell Stories. And it's specifically about research that's going on in Scotland. They did a little tour of it around parts of Scotland. Anyone who wants to know a little bit more about this really important and obviously going to be increasingly important field of medicine, you'd make quite a good start if you know absolutely nothing about it. You'd know a little bit more after you've read this comic.
I do now, yeah. It's an interesting thing because the potential is so vast in terms of curing illnesses, fixing people, helping people who are really suffering. But also you have the ethical issues of it and the research issues of it. And you talk about this a little bit and the need for it. I guess what I want to ask you is how it's affected your work, if it has at all.
I mean, I already knew roughly about stem cells and the arguments around them. And that question of regenerative medicine, it actually appears as a kind of plot point in my novel, The Night Sessions, which is set in a future Edinburgh. Since working on that comic, actually the way it has gone into my novel Descent is not anything specific about stem cells, but the center itself, or something very like it, a fictitious equivalent of it, features briefly in the novel. The main character, Ryan, becomes a sort of freelance science journalist. I got some idea of how science journalism and science publicity and public education, public engagement with science works. And there are, I think, I'd like to think there are some echoes of that in the book. I was actually trying to imagine what freelance journalism is going to be like in the online world we're moving into. I know already from my son Michael, who's a journalist, that it's a hard row to hoe even at the moment. There's a lot of competition and all of that, and what happens when journalists find themselves scrambling for work in an endless sea of information. So I had some ideas about that, which I put into it, including the idea that in the not too distant future, an editor will be the name of a kind of software rather than a person, you know. One of the things I'm trying to imagine in this book is how these ways of journalism driven by the need to create clickbait starts to interact with the news cycle and with the way that people relate to science, news, etc., etc. It's a minor part of the story, but it's one of these, I think it's one of the threads that go to make it up.
Ken McLeod, everybody. The new novel is called Descent. If you happen to hear this in time, he's launching the book at Blackwell's. It's going to take place on the 6th of March at 6:30. Tickets are totally free. Get yourself along. Go down. See a book reading. Do these things. They're very exciting and very fun. I'm sure he'll sign a copy for you. He'd appreciate your attendance. So thanks to Ken, and thanks to everybody else who joined us on the podcast. That's Kirsty Logan and, of course, Tim Sinclair. Check out their work online. Buy a copy of their books. Sit down, read something for a little bit. Take these earphones out of your ears. Don't worry. We'll be back in your ears very soon with a brand new episode. But until then, enjoy a good book.